It's my joy again for the third time to introduce Dr. Carl Truman, the Paul Woolley Chair of Church History at Westminster Theological Seminary, as he continues the Spiritual Life Conference lectures.
Yeah. Thanks again for the kind introduction. I'm sort of conscious that I haven't given you much spiritual life, really, in these lectures. If Philip Reeve was the herald of the great dark, then maybe I'm kind of the junior herald of the great dark. I want to, in the space of the next 25, 30 minutes, just run through fairly rapidly some headings, as much to sow thoughts in your mind as to present an argument at this point. These are things that I want you to be thinking about rather than me presenting a long argument. Really relating to how we think about sex, how we think about the changed function of sex. And the first point I want to make is that what we witness today is a fundamentally changed understanding of the function of sex and its institutions that have really moved sex from a social thing to personal fulfillment. And what do I mean by that? Well, I think in the past, and again, I'm talking ideal here. We all know that extramarital sex has gone on throughout history. But that was always regarded as not the norm, as less than the best, and as aberrant. The primary, the most perfect manifestation representation of sex was as part of an intimate and exclusive bond that identified a marriage in the face of everything and everybody else. That's how sex functioned. It's sort of, maybe it's even slightly distasteful to refer to the fact that consummations of marriages would often be witnessed in the past. In peasant societies, it was not uncommon for a consummation to be witnessed. It's not uncommon for signs of virginity to be produced the day after a wedding consummation in certain societies. Famously, of course, Luther's marriage was witnessed by Bugenhagen, who refers to it in a diary or a letter as being a most distressing experience. I have a friend of mine whose wife, Southern Baptist lady, said she could never read Luther again after she knew that. But, you know, joking aside, why were these things witnessed? It was not for the reasons we might immediately think, for some sort of titillation. They were witnessed because what was taking place was something of fundamental social importance. That's why I started these lectures by reading that passage from Genesis, because Genesis makes it very clear that the primary function of sex, well, there are two primary functions, we might say. One is the reproduction of children, but the second one is it's a social marker. It's a social marker. Now, of course, sex is not the seal of a permanent social relation, but a recreational activity to be pursued independent of marriage and commitment. And that's why, you know, the church has got a lot of sexual re-education of people to do. And the church's attitude to sex should not simply be, don't do it before you get married. I think the whole significance of it has to be brought out properly in the life and teaching of the church. Having said that, please, nobody, don't go and write a book on sex because nobody in the church is talking about it. Everybody in the church is talking about it, as far as I can see. Too many books have been written on it. We need good books written on this kind of topic that look at the social function. We need, if ever you've read Roger Scruton's book, Sexual Desire, which is a philosophical study of sexual desire, we need a Christian book of the caliber of that, dealing with sex in that kind of way. We might also add that not only is sex the seal of a permanent social relationship today, but when you think that marriage and commitment are now actually seen as inhibiting fulfillment and happiness, that makes the picture even bleaker. Every time a celebrity leaves their partner for somebody of the same sex, they're treated as a hero. And I'm always left wondering, well, what about the damage left behind? I got somebody in my church whose parents committed adultery, her father committed adultery when she was 17, and it has completely dominated her entire life. Shapes how she thinks about everything. And yet, contemporary society, it seems that marriage is actually seen as oppressive. entirely consistent, of course, with the view of Wilhelm Reich that I was putting out earlier. Marriage is no longer a lifelong monogamous bond for mutual companionship, social distinction, and for child rearing. It is a sentimental connection that has now been formalized in law as such. And again, as an aside, I agree with Robert George that I think the key shift on marriage took place with the advent of no-fault divorce. That's when marriage got redefined. No-fault divorce. Last July's Supreme Court decision is not as radical a decision on marriage, I don't think, as the arrival of no-fault divorce. And the churches have been complicit in that because we didn't do anything about it. We've been complicit in the redefinition of marriage. Thinking about how marriage changes definition, I'm reminded of the anecdote Bertrand Russell tells in his autobiography. In 1902, while riding on his bike, he suddenly realized in a flash that he was no longer in love with his first wife, and so the marriage consequently fell apart. Bertrand Russell redefined marriage on that day, I think. Marriage for him was just a sentimental bond. What does love mean? When you think about it, how radical an impact this has on how we understand words. What does love mean? What does it mean to love your wife? What does it mean to say, I'm no longer in love with my wife? I think the appropriate answer to somebody who says, I don't love my wife anymore, is to tell them, go away and love your wife. Because I'm not sure the sentence actually has any kind of coherent meaning as it stands when you understand what love is truly meant to mean from a biblical perspective. And interesting, just as an observation again here, it's interesting to me how even our language has shifted on this, even among Christians. We no longer make love, we have sex. Said to somebody recently, I can only make love to somebody that I'm actually in love with. I can have sex with a prostitute. I can only make love to somebody I have a relationship with. The language shift is interesting. Next point, I would suggest that sex, we have to connect our attitude to sex to the infantilism of society. Everybody's always saying people don't grow up these days. Well, one of the reasons why people don't grow up these days is we've stripped away all of the rituals of adulthood. And there was a time when sexual activity was an integral part of a move to a new social relationship that signaled the arrival of adulthood. You leave your mum and your dad, and you become one flesh with somebody else. And in Genesis 2, what's being described there is growing up. You know you're a grown-up because you're in this intimate flesh union with the person that you've married. It's one of the ways you know you're grown up. By making sex recreational, we have stripped away one of the major passages to adulthood. Genesis 2:24, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. He grows up. Therefore a man shall grow up, we might say that. I'd also add, the new politics of sexual identity annihilate history. I was asked last night, one of the faculty over dinner said to me, what's the end game here? What are these people pitching for? Is it all going to collapse? Well, I think one needs to remember that what's going on is profoundly anti-historical and very reductionist on the teleological front. Why is it anti-historical? Well, one obvious way of it being anti-historical is that millennia of understanding of marriage and sex have been overturned in the last 20 years. Now, again, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the family always looked the same everywhere. I'm not saying that marriage always functioned the same in all times and all places. I'm a student of the 16th, 17th century. In the 16th century, marriages, certainly noble marriages, were often contracted for political reasons. But marriage was always between a man and a woman. That has been completely overthrown. Even in Spartan society, which had a strong structural homosexual component to it, ultimately marriage was between a man and a woman. Don't even know anything about Spartan society, but the men and women grew up segregated and would engage in sexual relations with each other. And when Spartans married, the women would actually cut their hair and dress as men for the wedding night in order to make the transition easier. But even in Spartan society, marriage was still between a man and a woman. But there are more subtle ways, I think, that the sexual revolution has undermined history. Think about this. If human identity is tied to happiness, and happiness is primarily conceived of in terms of sexual satisfaction, then humanity changes its fundamental purpose from one intimately connected to history, that is both the past and the future, to one that is essentially bound to the present moment. The purpose of life is pleasure, sexual pleasure. That is a thing of the instant. It is not something one works towards. It doesn't have any teleology beyond itself. A couple of years ago, Niall Ferguson got into serious trouble and had to take this statement back. And whether he's true or not, I don't know. But he was talking about John Maynard Keynes and Keynesian economics. And he speculated that Keynes's homosexuality played into his understanding of economics. Because what did Keynes care if he borrowed on future generations' credit for achieving good things today? He was a homosexual with a short-term idea. He wasn't going to be producing children. He was not going to have any long-term investments in the future. And Ferguson, I don't know if Ferguson's right or not, but it struck me as an interesting observation. I think I would tighten it and say, if you believe the identity of humanity is tied up with sexual pleasure, then you will ultimately have little regard for the future. And I think there's plenty of evidence for that. I mean, think of the AIDS epidemic, how initially, at least, the whole idea of using condoms made such little impact because people didn't care about the long-term consequences. It was the power of the pleasure in the moment that fulfilled them as human beings. So in answer, that's to go back to the question last night, what's the end game in all this? I'm not sure there is an end game because I think a hedonistic culture, a culture that identifies human beings ultimately with hedonistic categories, isn't thinking about the future anyway, because the future has no significance. Go back to my grandfather, that question, you know, granddad, is your job satisfying? Yes, because it puts bread on the table and shoes on my children's feet. In other words, because it helps bring the next generation to adulthood so they can do it for the generation after them. You ask me if my job's satisfying, I'll probably give you a very different answer. Well, yeah, I do enjoy giving a lecture. I do enjoy lecturing. I do enjoy writing books or sitting on panels. Notice the difference in answer. Notice the difference in the answer. Amnesia, forgetfulness of the past and carelessness about the future is, I think, one of the characteristics of our present age. Again, return to Philip Reeve. This is another of his works. This is not the classic Triumph of the Therapeutic. This is from a posthumously published book, My Life Among the Death Works. Says this: cultures are constituted by the union of the living and the dead in rituals of living memory. Never before in our late second world, and he's not talking economically, second and third world for Reeve, and not the economic categories, he's talking about the sort of the development of culture. Never before in our late second world has the authority of the past been sacrificed with a more conscious effort of forgetfulness. Forgetfulness is now the curricular form of our higher education. Step out from the quotation a minute. Think of all the things that have happened recently. All of the, you know, my son's at Georgetown, they changed names of buildings. Now, on one side, one would say, well, there's an argument for that. Maybe the names of those buildings were named after really bad people. But it's also part of a general cultural disposition to get rid of the past, get rid of the burden, the obligations, whatever, of the past. Think of critical theory. Think of the historical work of Michel Foucault. What is it essentially? It's essentially iconoclastic relative to the past. This form, forgetfulness is now the curricular form of a higher education. This form guarantees that we, of the transition from second to third worlds, will become the first barbarians. Barbarism is not an expression of simple technologies or of mysterious taboos. At least there were taboos, and moreover, in all first worlds, the immense authority of the past. By contrast, the coming barbarism, much of it here and now, not least to be found among our most cultivated classes, is our ruthless forgetting of the authority of the past. Just working on a lecture I'm giving next week at Gettysburg College for the Ciceronian Society on Sophocles' play Antigone. And it's interesting that Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet, did a translation of Antigone. And in the afterword to that, he talks about how modern audiences can identify with Antigone because she's asserting a sort of individual human right against the state. But that's not what Antigone's about at all. The tragedy in Antigone is that she has to bury her brother. The state has forbidden the burying of her brother, and she has to bury her brother. It's her obligation to family and to the past that drives Antigone. What Reef is saying here, we're living in a world where those obligations are being dissolved. The past no longer has any purchase on us. Interestingly, I don't have it in front of me, but the specific example that Reef then goes on to highlight is abortion. He says abortion is exactly what you'd expect to find in a society that wishes to get rid of the past and also annihilate its future. And he talks about an abortion is what? It's a flushing of the past down the toilet. It's a rather graphic image, but captures the mentality. And I think that wider cultural sensibility is not unconnected to the sexual revolution, because the sexual revolution in so many ways militates against the past and sees no significance in the future. Think of the cult of youth. There are other aspects of this in modern society we want to look at. The cult of youth, for example. The long war against the family. The family is surely the primary structure for mediating the past to the present, as in the case of Antigone, and for imposing the obligations of the past upon the present. One could go back to the Enlightenment, where I started earlier on today, and trace Enlightenment attitudes to the family and find that they run parallel to the rise of psychological man. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, argued that children should be taken away from their parents and educated by their state. By the state, because the family would be an oppressive force in them. And for anyone who's a fan of Rousseau, by the way, he handed over numerous of his children to orphanages, knowing that that was a death sentence on them. He didn't flush the past down the toilet. He allowed it to rot away in state orphanages. And again, the war against history, the war against the family, I think it's a war against history. And it takes a sexual turn, does it not, in present society? Again, to quote Del Noce, the conservative Italian philosopher, talking about Wilhelm Reich, he says, what is the repressive social institution par excellence for Reich? To Reich, it is the traditional monogamous family. And he then, if we look at Reich, we can find the conditions of what Reich sees as freedom relative to the family. Talking about a 17-year-old girl. This is the ideal setting for a 17-year-old girl for Wilhelm Reich. For in order to satisfy sex economic requirements, notice the mix of Marxism and Freudianism there, sex and economy, sex and economic requirements, the girl does not merely need to be free genitally. She also needs privacy, a means of contraception, a sexually potent friend who is capable of love. Not a national socialist, he says, with his negative sexual structure. Doesn't like the Nazis. Understanding parents and a sex-affirmative social atmosphere. All the more so if her financial means of breaking through the social barriers against adolescent sexual activity are minimal. In other words, the family are not to do what they do traditionally. And that's instill limits, taboos, interdicts on children in order to bring them to adulthood. Families are merely to facilitate the sexual urges of their children and their satisfaction. Again, did a little article recently. I was thinking about the issue of modesty. It strikes me again, in Christian circles, we so often debate the limits of modesty. Try debating that in the outside world. It's the very concept of modesty which is now considered to be anathema, not the limits of modesty. The debate about pornography is not a debate about whether it is a legitimate expression or not. There is no debate about pornography, because that which one would propose against it, modesty, is repressive. Just, and I'll close here, one final thing. Is there any hope? Well, yes and no. I think if there is no hope, it lies in the fact that the forces ranged against us are so deep-seated and so powerful, it's hard to see how to respond. Because we have not lost the argument, we have lost the levers of cultural influence and power, I think there is no way back for us at a national level. So what is the response? I think the response is for the church to foster communities that represent what it truly means to be a human being. The answer, if you like, has to take place, I think, at a local level. There are issues, I think, in the legal world that perhaps point towards glimmers of hope. It seems to me that hanging one's sexual morality on the issue of legal consent is ultimately very unstable. Are there any children here? No. Oh, okay. Well, I won't use the example I was going to use then. But well, you think about paedophilia. You know, why is paedophilia wrong? Because the child cannot consent. Why is that not a strong argument? Because we live in a world where we get children to do lots of things they don't consent to. We insist they go to school, for example. So maybe one glimmer of hope is that the way that legal decisions are heading at the moment is ultimately insane and unsustainable in the long run. And secondly, there are hints in our culture that even with the downgrading of sex to a mere recreation, instinctively we know that it's more important than that. There is a strange schizophrenia, isn't there, on sex. We're being taught that it's purely recreational, and yet sex crimes are considered the most heinous things that one can commit in society. So maybe there's a glimmer of hope there. Maybe there's a glimmer of hope in society's ambiguous attitude to sexuality. That pretty much brings what I have to say to an end. I'll throw it open now for questions. I said this is very much, particularly as we work through the finals, you're very much a work in progress for me, so I'm very interested to get feedback. Very interested to receive probing questions or pushback on this.
And we have a microphone for questioners.
Well, first, Dr. Truman, thank you so much for this. This was a fire hose lecture that you're asking us to drink down. I've got two questions. One's very short. My first question is, how much of this is kind of a rehashing of old Gnostic categories where mind over matter, the body doesn't matter so I can do what I want?
Yeah.
Because it also seems like the body is the most important thing. So maybe that's the irony. I wonder if you could speak to that. And my second question is, what are three books that we can read that will lift us out of the cultural junk and get us into deeper thinking?
Yeah. On the first question, I think there are affinities. The downgrading of the body is, it clearly shares something with Gnosticism. On the other hand, the sovereignty of the, bodies are still important. As I said yesterday, that strange thing in the transgender argument, that on the one hand, my body is irrelevant to my identity. On the other hand, I need my body altered to fit my identity. So I'm not sure that it's quite as straightforward as a simple downgrading of the material world or of bodies. So I would see affinities, and I've always been somewhat skeptical of people who go back in history and try to find exactly what's happening now before. There are a whole host of categories we're now operating with in today's politics that would not have been available to Gnostic thinkers. So there are some categories there. There are some affinities, but I think that there's a lot that separates us. Three books that could be useful. I certainly think Philip Reeve's Triumph of the Therapeutic, but it's a tough... I mean, the reason why I came across this was I was approached by a publisher saying, would you be willing to do a reader's guide to this? And I said, well, I never read it. I'd have to read it first. And I got hooked, and I've started to read everything I can by him. Now, he's hard to read. It's taken me a long time to really get into him because he was a Freud scholar, and he's coming from a background very different to my own. But I would definitely say The Triumph of the Therapeutic by Philip Reeve. I think Charles Taylor, and I'm not sure which one to whether to recommend, A Secular Age or Sources of the Self. Maybe Sources of the Self, which is slightly less well known. But Charles Taylor is an interesting figure to engage with. James K.A. Smith has a... In fact, it was James K.A. Smith's book that inspired this request to me about Reeve. Somebody said, would you do for Reeve what Smith did for Taylor? He's got a good book on Taylor's Secular Age that would give you an avenue into how Charles Taylor thinks. Again, he's a... You know, it's not limpid prose. It takes a lot of wading through. The third book I would recommend... well, I'm inclined to say anything by Roger Scruton. First of all, it'll be a breath of fresh air after you've waded through those first two guys, because Roger Scruton, S-C-R-U-T-O-N. So Roger Scruton can actually write concisely. So he's a pleasure to read. What I would recommend of him, I've got a friend, there's a New Testament scholar, and is not on the same page with me theologically, in Chicago, Scott McKnight, and we team read Scruton together. We'll read the same Scruton book and exchange emails on it. I'm trying to think of a good one to recommend. He did one on wine. I drink, therefore I am. Couldn't recommend that at Southwestern the other week when I was there. But I could recommend his book on hunting, though, because Paige Patterson would have appreciated the book on hunting, even though it was with hounds, not with submachine guns or whatever Paige Patterson hunts with. Problem with a rifle is you can only hit one thing at a time, I think, from his perspective. I would suggest his most recent, Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands. It's a revision and a reprint of a book that effectively finished his academic career in the 1980s in Britain because it was critical of the New Left. I would recommend that book as a good, not only is it a good introduction to Scruton's way of looking at the world, it's also a good critique of some of the left-wing stuff that I've been touching on behind the scenes here. Yeah. No, oh, I'm a historian. I don't do the. I have no mantic utterances on that. As I said, history shows that societies can commit suicide and can pull back from the brink. And until they do one or the other, it's impossible to tell in advance which way they're going to go. I think I'm confident to say it's definitely going to get worse before if it gets better. I think we've not seen the end of this. I think we've not yet seen the full working out, even of the legal decisions that have thus far been made. And I would anticipate worse legal decisions coming down the line. But I think it will get worse before it gets better. Do I see it coming out of it, or would I approve of it coming out of it? I can certainly see it coming out of it. Yeah. Yes, I think these are tense times on that front. And I would, without treading on anybody's toes politically, I would see Donald Trump's candidacy as in part a sign of frustration that certain people no longer, you can't have an intelligent debate on immigration in America anymore, because as soon as you say certain things, you're beyond the pale. And I think that frustration bubbles over in populist candidates on both right and left. Sanders and Trump seem to me to be good examples of where people are feeling disenfranchised. And where people feel disenfranchised, there's a danger of civil disobedience because they cease to see themselves as being part of civil society. When you have a president who doesn't attend the funeral of a Supreme Court justice. I got a lot of left-wing Democrat friends who were appalled by that and really felt that was not an inclusive gesture at all. And yet I think it's more typical of what's going on in our society than inclusivism at the moment. Yeah.
Kind of coming at this from a different angle, what do you think about Christian hedonism in our Reformed That's a bad. I mean, that's. But we're looking at it just from a different angle.
Yeah, I think about it as little as possible.
I shouldn't ask the question.
I'm in the OPC. Hedonism is taking ill-fitting shoes off at the end of the day. You know? I don't know a huge amount about it. My hesitations would be it could be a dangerously ambiguous vocabulary to use given the world we live in. Now, that's not to say that John Piper is not a good man and intending good things when he uses that language, but it's certainly language that one would have to be very, very careful to define. And my suspicion is there may just be easier ways of saying what you want to say. It's certainly language, you know, to draw a parallel with Martin Luther, Freedom of the Christian Man in 1520. The language, I think, is deliberately chosen to resonate with the language of the peasants and with a language that's, you know, in the late 15th century, the language is of justice. By the time you get to 1520, the language of the underclass is freedom. I think Luther deliberately plays to that by choosing that language. The price he pays is 1525, when they're claiming that he approves of this radical social revolution they're promoting. I suspect that hedonism may lend itself to not a peasant's war, but a similar kind of misconception.
I appreciate what you said yesterday about you're coming out of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and especially the notion of the spirituality of the church. As you know, my tradition was in the PCUSA, therefore their whole agenda was of a social nature, and the old PCUS. How can we, maybe could elaborate a little bit more on how you want to stay within the tradition of spirituality of the church while addressing this issue?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question, because I'm speaking at this pre-GA OPC conference. I think I'm the only OP guy on the panel, actually. But the Committee on Christian Education that set it up, there was a debate at the committee level about whether having this conference would infringe upon the spirituality of the church, because it's such a hot-button issue in society at the moment. So even this, in my own denomination, not everybody would see this as something the church should speak directly to. It's so hard to respond briefly to that, but I would say is, if you preach the word faithfully week by week, if you know the people you're speaking to, you talk to them, and you know the kind of issues they're facing on a daily basis, then if you're a good pastor, inevitably you're going to be touching on these things. One thing I most dislike about the kind of tradition of preaching that I sort of stand in, the redemptive historical tradition, is that everything tends to culminate in Jesus, and you just tell people about Jesus. And I try not to do that on a Sunday. I'm consciously thinking of what the people in my congregation are facing, and how would this text play out in a work situation. So for me, maybe I'm not as pure a spirituality of the church person as some people. Spirituality of the church means I'm not going to tell people how to vote. I'm not going to tell people that they have to picket an abortion clinic. I'm not going to tell people they have to go on a civil rights march. I'm going to preach the word faithfully. I'm going to apply it to their daily lives. And I'm going to trust that the Holy Spirit shapes their character. And to use McIntyre's terms, gives them virtues. That means they make virtuous and wise decisions when they're faced with these things. But I certainly believe that I have to speak in language, concepts, and to situations that people understand. And that requires me to speak about this from the pulpit once in a while when the text points me in that direction. Does that answer the question, Andy?
You referenced the Oscars a couple of times in these lectures. I was affected by the fact that when one of the awards that were given out was given regarding a movie about sex change back in the 30s, Danish Girl. And then on the other end, the best picture was Spotlight, which is dealing with the abuse of priests. And they talk about the heinousness of those acts. how do they reconcile that within their worldview when you say, well, it's because they couldn't consent? And you already said that there's a hole in that.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just a schizophrenia or inconsistency on their part, or is there some other way in which they try to reconcile that?
Yeah, good question. I mean, first of all, just as a comment, who'd have thought that the transgender movie would get an Oscar? I mean, I'm not a betting man, but I doubt I could even have got odds on that from any bookie who knew what's going on. I mean, it was like Philadelphia, the movie Philadelphia 20 years ago. You knew that the AIDS movie, and it's a pretty good movie actually, but you knew, I've not seen the transgender one, the Philadelphia movie, you knew it was going to get the Oscar for precisely the reasons I was talking about this morning. It's a commercial, and they're putting their brand approval on the commercial. In terms of the schizophrenia, I'm not sure that they would necessarily see themselves schizophrenic on that point, because a transgender person who has the operation consents. Of course, consent is an incredibly, when you get into what does consent mean and how do you consent? That's an incredibly complicated issue, as debates about euthanasia and end-of-life stuff has indicated. But I suspect they would hang it entirely on the consent. These priests were in positions of power and authority and abused children who had no choice, whereas the person in the movie chose to have the operation, to be who they really were. So I don't think that the establishment would see any tension on that particular point. Where I would want to address them is, well, what do you mean when this guy consented? What does consent mean? What does, you get back to our question about free will and determinism and social conditioning. So that's where I would possibly try a sort of apologetic press on that. But I'm not sure that I could see necessarily an inconsistency there.
Dr. Truman, how have your observations on these issues affected the way that you pastor your people? Very, very broad answer.
Sorry, that involves a major gear change in my mind. Well, on one level, and this is just a personal comment, it's made me realize how fortunate I am to have the jobs I have. Because as much as this may becoming down the pike and be a big issue for seminaries, not-for-profits, whatever, in 5 or 10 years' time, for many of my congregation, it's been an issue for some years now. I was chatting to a guy at the weekend, not in my congregation, another one, who was saying, but when he phones the computer helpline at his work now, he has to say, diversity in the workplace is good, before he'll get connected to wherever he's got to go to. Well, these people in congregations are under huge pressure all the time from things like that. So the first thing I would say is it's made me grateful for the calling I have and made me very impatient with pastors I hear who moan about their calling all the time. Some of them have bad callings, I understand that. Most of us just like to whine about how bad our calling is, where actually it's better than most people's callings. So on one level there's that. Secondly, it's made me acutely aware that preaching is even more important than I thought it was, because it doesn't matter if my congregants aren't watching pornography all week long. They'll be watching commercials, they're watching sitcoms, they're watching movies, and that stuff has a powerful way of capturing the imagination. So I get them for an hour on a Sunday morning, and I got 35 minutes of a sermon to really press home vital truths. The world is preaching at them 6 days a week, using very powerful media. I'm just one guy behind a pulpit for 35 minutes. It's made me realize that preaching is that much more important. Thirdly, it's meant, and going back to the answer I gave to Andy, these kind of things are always in the back of my mind when I'm preparing sermons now. How do I... Like the other week, I talked about I was talking about the word coming in judgment to Eli, 1 Samuel 2. And I made the point about the word comes from outside to Eli and tells him what's going to happen, defines who Eli is at this particular point in time. And that allowed me then a little bit of a springboard to that voice inside your head. That's not Jesus, and it's not you. It's who you want to be. And sometimes that voice is right and sometimes it's wrong. But it isn't really you. You want to know who you is? You got to look at the Word of God, the Word that comes from the outside. So that would be, thirdly, that would be one simple application. I actually did mention transgenderism at that point, but I didn't go into any great detail. I said, it's a great example of the voice inside somebody's head lying to them. And I used that as a springboard then for... We're circling back to the second point and saying, that's why sitting under the preaching of the Word is important, because the Word comes from the outside and tells you who you are. Mm. And if a member of my congregant had said to me, but I don't like being told who I am, I said, that's the exact problem. You know, that's modern culture. You want to tell you who you are. So three, there are probably more, but those are the three that come to mind.
You want me to go ahead? In the sense of practical theology, I want to know how you can help us to think about what steps should we take when the family comes to a church and they have a transgender child, and the child, I mean, I've seen instances of them in the nursery using the wrong restrooms, or what are we going to do in youth group when the transgender person wants to go to the D-Nail sleepover and the guy wants to go? I mean, this is going to play out in real ways in the church, and we're heading there, and I don't think we're prepared with how to handle it.
Well, I'm about to give you evidence that we're not prepared by saying I don't really know the answer to that question at this point. I think it would depend on the specific circumstances, but that would be, there probably isn't a one-size-fits-all answer. But that, I have no immediate advice on that point. I have wrestled long and hard with what happens if an adult who's had the operation comes to my church and is converted. What do I do? And for, I wasn't sure, do I accept their new identity or do I revert to their old one? And I've come to the conclusion, a man who's had a sex change operation is a mutilated man. And as hard as it might have to be to say that to somebody, I think I would have to say, you know, you need to live as a man. The Lord made you a man. You need to live as a man. You're mutilated, and that's a tragedy, but the Lord made you a man. Now, I know there are difficult cases, the intersex people born with, but I don't build my general case law on exceptional cases. Nobody, that's crazy to do that. So there would be difficult situations where there may be a case of having to choose which, you know, genuinely choose which way to go. But that's not the case with most. The bizarrest, and this is kind of, it's a sad but funny story. The most bizarre case of transgenderism I heard about was about 10 years ago. An elder in a Baptist church in Texas had the operation and became a woman, and then resigned from the eldership because he objected to women in ordained office. You know, do you laugh or do you cry at that? But that's how crazy it is. The other thing I would say is, I didn't get to this, but one of my final points would be, what a nightmare of a world we're now actually introducing children into. I used to do this thing, I haven't done it for some years now, in my exams. I would set the exam, and I would always put I would say to the students, if you don't like any of the questions, just invent your own and answer it. And nobody ever did. Nobody ever did, because freedom is a terrible thing. You know, that kind of radical freedom is terrifying. If we are saying to our children, you've got to even decide what gender you are, that is a horrible, horrible burden to place on children. If we ever did get to a position where for you to say to your child you're a boy or a girl is potentially opening you up to a future lawsuit for child abuse. If we ever got there, that'd be a terrible thing. Because freedom is always best realized, I think, in a social context. As selves, as Charles Taylor says, as selves are generally only selves in relation to other selves. So freedom only really exists when certain restrictions and constraints apply. So I just, you know, throw that out there. This is a terrifying world to bring children into.
In light of the controversial nature of the topic that you personally feel called to, I'm sure you've faced opposition. And I would just love to hear what you've learned during this time, because I imagine many of us here going into the ministry are going to have to deal with opposition. And
I've not actually, on this issue, because I'm in the early days, I've not actually faced much opposition. I did do something for First Things last year on they needed an article done on the teenager who'd killed himself, and Dan Savage got all uptight about it. And I did an article for them on that. And I turned up at the head office in New York about 3 days later. As I walked through the door, the editor laughed and said, here's the guy who got us the firebomb threat or something like that. So, you know, thankfully they got First Things address, not my private address. So it's out there, but it's not hit me yet. I guess it's probably only a matter of time, but I do live in a fairly sheltered world. You know, it's not that I'm a high-profile person. The only other people who know about me outside of Westminster are generally people who are broadly sympathetic to me on this issue. So nobody's connected the dots back to my domestic address yet. And I've not mentioned to my wife. I don't tell her when I'm writing about this stuff. She doesn't want to know. But it could get hot. The opposition I faced was more in relation to things that Ligon mentioned earlier. I mean, a lot of opposition at the seminary relative to some reforms we brought in there 8-10 years ago. Had a lot of opposition there. And one of the things that I found interesting about that, you always, like, as you've hinted at in your question, you always wonder if you're going to have the backbone. It's one thing to write an article. It's another thing to actually sit in a room and get into it with people from a position of weakness, which is where the reforms originally came from. There's always that question of, am I going to be strong enough to stand? What interested me in Westminster 2006 to 2009 was there weren't many of us on the side that I was on, but we were all good friends. And I think the Lord often provides Christian with friends, and it's easier to be strong when you've got a friend than it is on your own. So my encouragement to you would be, probably when you have to take a stand, you won't be taking it entirely on your own. You might be the point guy, but you'll have other people supporting you. And I remember getting a letter from a young guy, 2008, that I still keep in the wooden box at the side of my bed. Just, you know, guy nobody would ever have heard of, but he came up to me at a conference and he handed me a handwritten letter. And it just said, "Know what's going on at Westminster, and I've been praying for you." And I keep that letter in my bedside, little wooden box the side of my bed. And that letter meant a huge amount to me at the time. It was kind of, there are other people out there who care. You know, there are other people out there who care. And I think that kind of thing you'll find when you face, as you will, conflict and opposition. You know, make sure you've got some good friends. Use your time at seminary to build lifelong friendships. When you take a call to a church, build friends. I think this idea that ministers shouldn't have friends in the church is complete nonsense. Absolute rubbish. Makes the minister less than human, frankly, in his relationships with people. Build friends so that when the opposition comes, you don't stand on your own.
I know you had mentioned the parallels drawn between what's going on now and how the gay rights movement sort of leverages the plight of the civil rights in order to push the agenda forward. Without getting into my own personal feelings on that, could you, if you could, flesh that out a bit? How in the world was that accomplished?
I mean, I think it's accomplished philosophically by the kind of moves I described this morning, that if sexual repression is the equivalent of oppression, then any sexually repressed group is an oppressed group or an oppressed minority. I think the real problem that people like me would face legislatively, for example, if you're trying to press for traditional marriage, and we saw this rhetorically a lot over the last 2 years, is that people immediately throw the Jim Crow word at you. You're pushing for Jim Crow. You're pushing for second-class citizenship. I think one can make a good case for saying that's not the case. You know, I'm not wanting gay people or trans people locked up. What I don't want is the issue becoming the point of the spear that crushes religious freedom. But the rhetoric is very deeply ingrained, and it's very hard to argue against if you're a white guy, because civil rights rhetoric isn't my rhetoric. It didn't belong to me in the first place to say who has ownership of it. So it's got to be an African-American guy, I think, who makes the case in the public sphere that there is no close parallel between the two things. And I think neither historically nor philosophically is there a close parallel between them. I don't think there is any evidence suggests that gay and transgender people were systematically marginalized in the way that African Americans were in the United States. I don't think there's any. Sure, there are examples of terrible abuses and beat up, but nothing to the systematic side of that. And secondly, I think philosophically the two issues are different. It strikes me that, and again, I'm a British guy coming to America from the outside, so you know, be charitable if I get the race issue wrong. It's something I really do steer clear of commenting on because it's not mine to comment on. But my impression of reading people like Martin Luther King or W.E.B. Du Bois is that their press for equality, their press for civil rights, was predicated on an understanding of a common human nature. That there is such a thing as human nature. And because African Americans and Hispanics and Anglos share in a common human nature, therefore we should be equal before the law. And I think I'd make a case for saying that the sexual revolution, particularly as it's now blossoming into transgender kind of issues, is predicated on a denial of a common human nature. There is no common human nature beyond the self that imposes an authority upon me. So I would make a philosophical case for saying actually they're two different things. The problem is the civil rights rhetoric has been appropriated so effectively by those pressing for this that it's hard to argue against. Impossible for a white guy to argue against. Hard, I think, for an African-American leader to argue against now, but an African-American leader would be the only one who could. Does that answer the question? And I, again, touching on the race issue, I hope I didn't say anything inappropriate there.
We're at 1 o'clock now, and Carl, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Quickly, you have to get